All right, let's get back into the marketing. And also, Todd and I had an interesting talk when we were trying to figure out what to do about panels for this year's meeting. And as it comes out, we have been noting the trends over the year. Small farms are getting larger, large farms are getting really large, and really large farms are getting huge. And so we were thinking that maybe as people put together strategies to add more land to their farm operations, which seems to be a trend, that maybe how you go about the process of marketing, how you go about the process of farming, how you go about the process of handling other people, how you go about all the things that you do when you move from a small operation to a large operation would be worth exploring. And that is what we are going to do today with our big, and I called it the big producers panel, but they're not fat. So the big producers panel are three folk. They're John Bondurant. You saw him a little bit this morning. He's out of Tennessee. Danny Stevens, he farms in six counties, including a couple here in Indiana. I think Warren and Benton, for sure. He's been a farmer since 1962. He's raised cattle and hogs. He's had a tile laying business. He's owned a trucking business. He has a lot of experience about being a business person. And then Chuck Shelby, and he has a sizable number of acres, farms just south of Lafayette, Indiana, in Shelby Township. You can ask him about that if you want. So with no further ado, Todd, thank you.
Thank you very much. Give Dave a nice round of applause. One quick thing, and I know Dave wouldn't have asked this, but I'm going to, because I don't work for the radio station. I work for University of Illinois Extension. So when you go to give, the $50 is great. That's fine. Sign the check. Sign the paperwork. That envelope that's sitting there, that's the white one, I figure today is worth a bit more than $20. So if you can put a free will offering in there, we would really appreciate it. We won't ask again. These folks up here would not have asked. I will, because I have that opportunity. So let's talk to these folks about being a fairly large operator and what that means. This came out of a discussion that Dave and I had a conversation with the governor of Mato Grosso about 2 years ago. He's the world's largest soybean producer, right? Yeah, Maji. And he was in at the university, and I had a discussion with him about the acreage he farmed, how many acres he farmed, and there were probably 12 producers along with him. And we headed to Robinson, where the ethanol plant is, because they wanted to see the ethanol plant. They wanted to see a corn ethanol plant in particular. They have plenty of sugarcane ethanol plants, and they own some of them. And on the way down, I was kidding one of the guys in the back, because Maji doesn't really speak English. And so, but you could tell he was just always had numbers running through his head. They were just there constantly, consistently, always thinking about what the economic numbers meant. And I asked one of them, I said, is that the way he became the world's largest soybean producer? And the guy in the back said, oh, he's not the world's largest soybean producer. That guy is. So in that van, we had 300,000 hectares, Maji. And we had something bigger than that, but they didn't tell me how big he was. That was a big crew. Now, I did ask them if there were some things that, when they grew, where did it cut off? Were there efficiencies? And that's what we're going to talk about today. Where were the efficiencies? What happened? And for Maji, the efficiency came in two things. He bought everything together for all 300,000 hectares, but he needed to divide it into about 100,000. Actually, not hectares, acres. But he needed to divide those farms into about 100,000 acres because geographically he had to have equipment over those areas. So at 100,000 acres, he had to cut farms up, and that's where he found his efficiencies when he became very big. I suspect that the folks up here have some efficiencies that they can talk about as well. So what, you know, I almost hate to ask this question, but let's begin with your farm operation. Tell me the things you want to let me know about your farm operations, and then we'll ask you some of the things that you might not want to let us know about that. Chuck Shelby.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and congratulations on many years, and this is a great turnout today. I look at myself as a family farmer. I'm a fifth-generation farmer, and my great-great-grandfather, who surveyed a lot of part of Indiana, is buried up on our farm. I went to Purdue University and graduated in Ag Econ, so I'm a Boilermaker, and Dave Dickey and I have very many discussions at a lot of meetings. But
I've been moving a lot lately.
I'm eating well. That's why he brought up the weight thing. But we've grown over the years. We started out a farm with my dad and started out with 350 acres, and he had about a 500-acre farm. And as time went on, we've grown to about 8,000 acres, mostly corn, soybeans, a little bit of wheat. We have a small cattle herd. And my middle son has come back to the farm. I graduated in Ag Econ 3 years ago and farms with me. So part of my growth, I guess, or how did I grow, was I went out and found investors to invest in farmland many years ago before it was really fashionable. So most of the acres we've grown has been finding investors, and that was a long-term vision of working with somebody who I could work with for the long term. And another important part of growth to me is to have someone like my son that I can continue the operation and continue our farm into the sixth generation.
Can I ask a real quick question? Were the investors for cash rent or for purchase when you bought for the land?
Actually, the two biggest ones we do on 50-50 relationship and always have. Part of that, you know, part of in my success has been successful has come from marketing. I learned many years ago how important marketing was. I started, became a commodity broker in 1991. And so a lot of that goes to the credit of my dad. He was the one who got me interested in marketing and got me to the first meeting that I didn't understand a word they talked about at that meeting, Todd. But from then, that's been one of the successful tidbits or helping things I could tell you is marketing has been real important for me to be successful in farming.
By the way, you can hear Chuck on the Commodity Week program from time to time. He works with Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana. Denny Stephens, a bit about your operation.
I got out of school in 1962. I was farming with my dad. At the time, we farmed about 1,200 acres. We growed till my dad got terminally sick in 79. We were farming about 2,200 acres. We bought our first land in the late 60s, $450 to $500 an acre. Bought two or three farms. Got pretty well established. We didn't buy any land in the 70s when things got high. In the 80s, we started buying a lot of land in the 80s. They'd have auctions. They wouldn't sell the farms. We bought several thousand acres between $1,300 and $1,600 an acre. Land kind of went up. We got in the 90s. I seen my sons were coming back to farm, and we started hitting it again. And $2,200 to $3,400 an acre. We bought roughly 30-some thousand acres of land in that period of time. We were dealing with some local brokers, real estate people. We had people out of Chicago, Indianapolis, Noblesville. They were farmers. They were receiving $100,000 to $300,000 an acre for the property, and they seemed to like our family, and we made some big strides. We was turning $1,200-$1,500 an acre and renting these farms back, and some of them we didn't rent back, but that's how we got started with 1031s.
Yeah, so you grew through 1031s and investors.
Investors. And we didn't keep all our farms. but we kept enough to get our base with my boys to come back. And, you know, we worked through a couple banks, and a lot of times we had a lot of money. You know, we kind of stuck our neck out buying these farms, but we had the wealth to do it. And so, but we kind of ceased in the last couple of years.
John Bondurant, tell me about your place.
I've been a commodity trader all my life, and where I was in the early 80s, farmland was around 2,000 an acre. And they weren't making any more, and everybody was mortgaging farmland to Hilt. And then from 82 to 86, in our area, the farmland dropped from 2,000 to 500. So two friends of mine, we decided that we were inflation boys, and so we just started buying farmland. And we bought all the land we farmed. We bought in 1986, 1987, and unfortunately, I've sold some of it off. I wish I hadn't, but all of a sudden, farmland in our area is starting to really go up. But when we bought it, farmland T-bills were bringing about 5%, and you could buy land for $500 and cash rent it for $50, so that was 10%. So it seemed like a better deal if you had cash, and we were very much worried about inflation. I've always been worried about inflation. That was my prime motivating force for buying farmland.
Since you all talked about the investments to begin with, would you advise an investor to buy farmland today, or would you do it yourself?
A combination. There's a fair amount of people out in this country that have money, and there was recently a farm sold in our area where the guy bought 465 acres and took money out of a CD and looked at that many acres as a wise return compared to what was going on. And, you know, we also look at buying if the right land is available. But investor money out there, with the volatility and what's going on, they're still attracted to farmland. They're probably making the market to me more so than farmers right now.
We bought a farm a year and a half ago, probably at the high, but we turned around and sold almost that many acres away from home and brought it back to keep with our home farm. That's been our strategy. You know, we got farms, you know, stretched out 30, 40 miles around.
And so you traded it out for something closer.
That's correct.
John?
The prices, some of the prices being paid, and there's no way the farm can ever make it if you're on any kind of debt service. And I'm very much worried about interest rates going out the roof, so I would not be a buyer. If somebody popped along and put a big price, I would be a former farmer. But
all right,
you know, you do $200 cash rent on $6,000 land, it just doesn't work.
$300,
but you're paying $7,500. Still, it's tough.
Yeah,
if you're on
into the mics, guys. Okay, I thought maybe we'd talk about the efficiencies that you found. John, I suspect you found some efficiencies somewhere along the lines. What are they? And your organization operation probably going to be a little different than what we have here in the Midwest.
Well, I'm an owner-operator. I don't cash rent anything, so I do all my farming through managers. And I'm not really a farmer. I'm a city boy, but I do all the hedging. And I personally think that farming's at least 50% marketing. And that's my forte, is marketing. And one of the efficiencies, I guess you'd say, is when you go out and you've got 100,000 bushels of beans or 100,000 bushels of corn to sell, ADM or Cargill is going to pay you a good bit bigger price than they're going to pay the small farmers. So I guess that's the only efficiency I have. But and another thing I use a lot is futures. We have 4 or 5 different crops that we can raise in the South. And frequently, I remember one year I was real bearish on corn and sold corn at $3. And we had a horrible drought and had aflatoxin and everything else and pulled the hedges at $1.85. All those had a horrible year farming, but I made a lot of money on the board. And so we have had several times where we've hedged one crop at a very high price, have it fall out of bed, take the futures profit, plant something else. And I would encourage people to think that there's some flexibility. Now, you're basically corn and soybeans, but it's certainly believable that you can have times like last year when you had $7 corn at times, and you can plant a lot more corn and less beans and flip them. But I'm a great believer in hedging. I find farmers frequently will say, well, I just don't want to hedge because, gosh, what if I sell 25% of my crop and the market goes up on me? I'm dead. And I'm thinking, my God, they got 75% they didn't sell, and it goes down, and that doesn't worry them. When the market gives you really good opportunities, I firmly don't believe in any of this baloney about 25%. I'll go 100%. I mean, literally. I was 100% hedged all last year. I'm 80% hedged for this year. I'm 25% hedged for next year. But how many times have we ever looked at $10 and $12 beans? I mean, and particularly a new crop. I mean, we've never seen situations where old crop beans would be, say, $12, when new crop might be $8. Well, now because of long-only index funds, they're both $12. So it makes a heck of a hedge. So I would encourage anybody that's farming big time to have a long, serious chat with their banker and arrange to be able to hit margin calls. I mean, I almost ran out of money when it went to $15. Mm.
That was actually my next question for you, was how do you deal with the banker if you're hedging that much? These folks had to deal with that when we went to $7, and they couldn't really make the cash sales.
The farmer,
they could not make that cash sale. They had to take that on themselves if they were going
to
do
it. On the board. They had to take it on the board because
they had to take it on the board, but they had to have somebody finance that.
And the bankers don't really understand hedging. I mean, let's face it. I had one ask me, I said, you hedged all this cotton one time. This was in the last 6 years, the president of the bank, a big bank. He says, gosh, you've got a big loss in these futures. Gosh, that's got to really hurt you. I said, well, wait a minute. The cash cotton is way up. And they just don't understand hedging. And so if you're going to do it, I think you really got to talk to your bankers and make them understand what you're doing and sit down and tell them it costs me this much to raise soybeans and corn, and I can make this much, and please finance my hedges.
I bet. I've always wanted. I didn't know you used farm managers, but I bet they just despise you when it comes to the spring. And you say, no, not that, but this is what we're going to plant today.
That's not true. I make plans a lot ahead. But, I mean, it's not hard to switch ground from corn to cotton in a month because they're both rowed up and ready to go. But basically, my philosophy is you just look out there, and one of the crop makes you a lot of money, and it doesn't mess up your rotation or whatever your practices are, you go for it, and go for it big. So that's been my farming.
Denny Stevens, what kinds of efficiencies do you look at in your operation? What are the things that help make it work?
We've bought elevators that we have close to our farming operations where we don't have to move our grain from our field to our elevators very far. And it's like last fall, a lot of people had trouble. We never had a bit of trouble. We can harvest 100 to 150,000 bushels a day. We got dryers to dry it. We got bins to put it in. Those are things you have to do if you're a large, that's a problem. But you got to solve it. A farmer farming large acres, he's got to have a flight plan, like flying a plane. You got to have a plan. A lot of these people, they want to farm all this ground, but they don't know how to handle the grain once they want to, And that's where a lot of people had problems. And your local elevators, they just don't understand these large combines and people raising more grain and yields are up, and that's where we excel on our farms.
So the first two, you and I heard you talk about one to buy a grain elevator, but didn't, right? Is that right, John?
I agree. We bought a lot of storage. We got to $2 a bushel under the board 2 years ago. We didn't sell a single bushel, carried it all for another year, and sold it, rolled the hedges. And by the time we rolled the hedges, we ended up selling it even the board because we had the storage. And the $2 a bushel paid for what we paid for the storage. So we paid for the storage in 1 year.
You can make your farm payments on the carry and the basis a lot of times.
Absolutely.
Are you both willing to leave your storage empty?
Oh,
two, if necessary.
Sure.
Just ship it all.
When we had $6 corn, $7 corn, we took it to town. We just put it to bed and look at it.
Boom, baby.
Yeah,
it goes.
I'd love to have it empty every year, but yeah. I think owning storage is the best deal going.
All right. Chuck, what kind of efficiency on your place?
I think there's probably, in the chemical side of it anymore, I mean, the chemical business has gotten pretty generic. I mean, you can go to Rural King and buy your Roundup. So there's not, I don't think there's a whole lot in chemicals. In recent times, I think fertilizer and nitrogen, there's some advantages there. There's some advantages to smart buying going on in fertilizer too. One area that I think we have some advantages in is machinery. When I first started farming, it was, I needed to buy this combine and have a loan and try to pay it off and own it. But now we don't look at it that way. We just look at the cost per acre to use that machine. We trade our machinery pretty much on a yearly basis and just look at it. I don't look at trying to own that combine. I just look at it, how much does it cost me to run it per acre? And there are some advantages to buying machinery in multiple units.
You don't lease, but you buy the machine, right?
It's a buy, but again, it's a roll every year. And again, I don't ever plan on paying off that loan. I don't have any need. I own my house, but I don't need to own my combine.
Okay, so now I've come to the point where I probably need some help from you because I don't farm, right? So I need some questions from out here. What do you want to know from these guys that are fairly large operators? Yes, sir.
Does John think that changing genetics is going to bring more corn to the south?
Drought-tolerant? Oh, okay.
Oh, absolutely.
The question is, will the change in the genetics allow him to plant more corn?
Well, we had the 150-year low in cotton acreage all went to corn this last year. I mean, every acre you can drive through the heart of the cotton belt in Mississippi, and you can drive 6 or 7 miles and see nothing but corn. So it's already happened. This year we're going to lose corn acreage to soybeans and maybe gain back some cotton acreage. But, I mean, we're 150-year low. It's astounding. So we've already done it. And it's because of irrigation. Everybody's putting in tons of irrigation.
Other questions? So the thing I think I've heard so far is that all three of these folks try to do some vertical integration. How much of your storage do you own? Are you in the same boat where you have a lot of storage or not?
We have a lot of storage and always have built storage and drying. But, again, it's just to get through harvest and capture the carry, as Denny said. It's not a marketing tool. If you have grain in the bin, you are long futures. I've gone over and over. You got to get it in your head. You're long futures, and why do you want to have 10,000 bushel, 50,000 bushel in the bin? You can do the same things. Got to happen. Got to go up in Chicago other than the basis. So there's no need to use the bin as a futures tool.
Other efficiencies that you have on your place? You said you did a lot of 1031s. Most of these folks will understand moving farmland so that it's closer to the home place.
We've got our own fertilizer plant. We buy fertilizer. We've got our own ammonia tanks. We've got our own, you know, these companies forced us that way. I mean, we do all our own work. A fertilizer company can't handle me when I want to plant corn. I may want to plant 1,500 acres a day. There's no way they can handle me. I got to be self. So, but by doing that, we buy our fertilizer direct. We go to the river. We go, you know. I mean, we bought a lot of ammonia for $330 a ton for this season. You know, that's a big advantage to what the local, I don't know what the local market is now, but.
So you're able to buy a barge load or half a barge load at a time and store it and move it. That's a lot of fertilizer. Yes, sir.
I got a three-part question.
Okay. Okay, how big is the combine in size? How many acres do you want to run through it in a day and calculate that into hours in a day?
We only own four combines. We run, but I hire a lot of local people that like to buy machinery and like to run it. And when my corn gets to 20%, they're ready. They come in there with semis, combines, auger carts, and men that I don't have to do, and I hire them to. But I got a place to get rid of the corn. That's the biggest place. Most people don't have a place to get rid of the corn.
Which part of that machinery do you own? You own the four combines, but you don't own the semis and the auger carts, but the guys who drive the combines do?
I own the four combines, but I'll hire two other. I maybe run six or seven combines, you know, besides my four.
So you got local farmers with their combines.
We run two 80-20s. We have a lot of smaller fields. Another key component is you got trucks. I mean, Denny and I learned a lot from Denny over the years, but we've got our own semis. But the ability to get around, we got a lot of little fields, so we might be a tick oversized. But that's another limiting factor to me in growth is when you add another combine, you got to have the capacity to haul it and the capacity to get rid of it. So to me, when I look at growing, it's almost related to combine size when you make that jump or you got to rent one.
It is the biggest single expense on the farm, right? Is it your biggest single offense?
But in an average harvest, you can drive through the country 10 or 15 miles in my neighborhood, and you'll see combines and auger carts sitting on the end of the fields. You know, if my combine's sitting, somebody's getting an ass shoe.
How many hours a day do you run your combines?
A lot.
18, 20, 24? All of the above.
We don't run that many. We're probably 14-hour, maybe 16-hour. That's.
But you're doing it yourself, and you're not in the can.
We're on the 3 o'clock. You know, I've got semi drivers want to quit me because they're wore out, you know. But, you know, when it's time to harvest, you got to harvest.
Right.
John, your combine setup?
Being a city boy, we start about 9:30 and go to about 9 o'clock, and that's about the way it works. And we've got one farm has three combines, and that's a big farm, and the other one has two, and it's a smaller farm. And we're harvesting from late August to. Should be through by the 1st of October, but not this year.
So how many acres, and I know one of the things he was trying to get at is how many acres you want to run through that combine in a year, which if we know how many combines you have, we have a rough idea how many acres you're running to, but how many acres do you want to run through a combine in a year?
We're running, each one's probably close to 4,000 gets through it.
And you say this is a lot, so you're...
Well, I'm thinking of my biggest farm. We have about 6,200 tillable acres on that farm. We have three combines, and it's a push to get that out.
We'll try to run that many acres to a combine.
And he's going to run 60. He's going to run 6,200 to one combine.
Three up. See, we're not as good a farmer. So. Obviously.
I'll take that here in a second. Let's see.
Needs to run it.
Yes. Bill Mayer. Okay, so we haven't talked about the employee situation. We know farming is seasonal. Some of these guys definitely need employees. They need employees that are well-trained. You don't want to put somebody in a combine that costs $200,000 that didn't finish high school unless they really know what they're doing in the combine. You want a good operator is what I'm trying to say.
$200,000.
$300,000.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I told you I don't farm. So how do you deal with employees, the seasonality of farming and having employees?
Our people work year-round. We do several things besides farming. When we get done farming, my sons, we got a tiling business. They'll take six, seven of those boys, and they'll start tiling. I take four or five of them. We're farming. Five or six of them, like when we get out and harvest, and we don't leave our corn in a bin, we just start hauling. I got four or five guys in semis delivering corn to town. I've got four or five guys who are spreading fertilizer and doing those things. We've got three or four guys on dozers and track hoes. We clear trees. We're still cleaning up farms and neighbors' farms. So we're doing several different things. But another big thing that's happening to us that's helped us, we bought farms in Benton County, and we're getting wind farms. This last phase, we got 24 turbines in one phase.
Wow.
And it's a big deal.
We had a lot of turbines.
I mean, in three different phases, I hate to say how many turbines we got. And when they first started through, they started knocking our corn down, and I was up there, and I just shaking my head. But I found out they paid us four times the price.
Anybody got a wind farm? Anybody else out here?
And we still
do. You love your wind farm? And the per no, you, you okay? Oh, you got a question?
Paper.
Have you any of you had a major loss because of weather?
1988, all three of them.
1991, I expanded and I didn't have crop insurance, and I was $91,000 in the hole. And I've told people that before, and that fortunately I worked my way out of that. But it taught me a good lesson. Risk management is the word. Yes.
We lost a wheat crop 3 years ago to frost. Went from 70 bushel wheat to 10 bushel wheat. But that wasn't real nice.
So despite the fact that they're big, they still suffer from the weather like the rest of you. Yeah, yes, right here.
How much bigger do you think you can expand to and still be efficient and somewhat enjoy a life?
So the question is, how much bigger can you get and remain efficient? And then the big question is, enjoy your life in the end of that process.
I enjoy my life for years. When Bob Knight was at Bloomington, I was down there every night to the ball game. He took me out for dinner. I never missed a game. And somebody says, how about stress? I give stress. I don't take it.
I believe that.
That's a fact.
But how much bigger you think you can get?
Well, it's just like Bob Wright. I'm good friends here, Bob. You know, and he says, you know, he can't grow because he needs more people. Farming, you can grow. When I was a kid, you had little equipment. Today, it's unbelievable what you can farm if you get the size of your fields. There's no limit to it. I mean, you can buy 20 row planters, 48 row planters, 60 row planters. I don't see a limit myself.
I think it's a generational thing. When we look out here, there's a lot of, what's the average age out here? I think there's a great opportunity for young people out there. The thing we've structured in our operation, I've got my son and I've got three young guys. And that's our plan for the future is, and again, I think the age is simply going to be fantastic for young people in agriculture. Right now there's a big battle over getting acres, but I think, again, it's not easy doing getting bigger. And that's certainly one of the issues is finding good qualified people. And the way we look at it on our farm, those guys, young guys, would like to farm on their own, but you know, they're not capable for whatever reason financially, or they can't get the land. So they're really farming with me, and that's the way I look at it. We're got to have good young people to go forward if you want to be larger as time goes on.
John, can you get bigger?
Well, sure. It's just it's a multiple game, but labor is one concern. Well, I will say one thing. Having farmland binds farms families together. Pass it down through generations, and I think it really helps to keep your children, your grandchildren, knowing each other and keeping up with each other, and I've seen a lot of that, and I think that's a wonderful thing about farming.
Yes, sir. So the question is to Chuck and Denny, when they go to see a 1031 broker, what kind of resume do they present to them?
I'd like to answer that because I've done probably as much as anybody in my neighborhood. I like the old-fashioned farmers, common people. I've had some bad experiences with bankers, lawyers, and doctors. there's good lawyers, but they're few and far between. I mean, none of them have a heart. Well, they just want more and more and more. You know, I've give up farms, after, and I'm sorry I ever dealt with them because life's too short.
So you just go on gut feeling.
Anymore, I just won't deal with them. If they come to me, a broker, I don't care what they're going to give me. I just don't want to, part.
So you just don't deal with them at all? Yeah, I know.
I really haven't done as much as a 1031. Most of the investment money I got was from doctors. I worked at a hospital, and my wife did too. So, and my daughter-in-law is a lawyer. So, but Denny calls it like it is. Like I said, all day long. He probably didn't know my daughter-in-law is a lawyer. So, do you need a good attorney now? I know a good one. So. But I really, it was more, relationship and knowing those people and learning that they had a long-term interest in agriculture. So it's a sorting process, finding the right people.
That's looking for them, but you're asking what they put on their personal resume when they hand it to the 1031 broker. So that broker says, this is the person I want to work with.
Coming to me. I got people coming to me. I don't go to them. Yes.
I got two questions back here. Yes. What do you do at tax time?
You pay a lot of taxes.
Other questions? That's a good question. So, have you purchased diesel fuel for the coming year yet? When we talk to the guys, we do the energy section on Tuesdays, every Tuesday. And they say buy, or said you should have bought, is what they're saying at this point. But have you booked your diesel fuel for the coming year?
Yeah, I did, but this year I screwed up big time last year, though I'll be happy to admit that. But yeah, I have bought it. Yeah.
No.
I have a wonderful experience in that. For about 5 years, I carried heating oil futures long as a proxy for diesel at 35 cents a gallon, and it went up to a dollar, and I thought, my God, I've made some money. Sold, and now it's three. I'm a real big bear on energy. I think natural gas is going to destroy crude oil, and we've got natural gas shale finds all over the world. We've got more efficient cars. We've got electric cars. We've got clean diesels. We all probably are familiar with peak oil. I think it's also peak demand for oil and nuclear. So, and we got so many places in the world that are shrinking in population. So I'm not a bull on crude oil or diesel at all.
Give these folks a big round of applause, please.